president. Let me drop.
The page is, Dick, is DSC07979JPG, and the technical data, page number 2, and then the other one, page number 1. So you can download these attachments and look at them. There's a two pages giving you all of the calculation and all of the data about the transformer.
Yeah, one of them is called Transformer Description Number 2, and one of them is called Transformer Description Number 1.
And you just open up those two.
What's the difference in those two?
Well, one is page number 1 and 2 is page number 2. He gave me two pieces, two white sheets of paper.
When I read the first page, 25 turns on the primary inductance, is that 4.712 millihenry?
That is correct.
I don't quite see the decimal point in this reproduction. All right, I'm going to keep reading. I'm having trouble seeing a difference between page 1 and page 2. They look identical.
So probably by mistake, I probably didn't send you the second one. Magnetization current. So hold on a moment. Variable U2, 2,500. Yeah, I sent you the same one. I'm sorry about it. I can send you another one, email, with the second page. I have to find it.
Yeah, there's two different document numbers, but the document itself is the exact same page.
I was trying to deliver the right one. I probably clicked the wrong one. From the information that you have on page 1, if you can relate something on it, I'm going to try to find the other one.
Okay, I'll keep reading.
Dick, if I may, I can give a description of the Caduceus coil for those who don't have a diagram, I think, which might be a little clearer for them. What do you think?
Fire away, John.
Okay, for those who are interested, if we had a 2-inch piece of PVC pipe, 10 inches long, and at the bottom, we start a winding, 1.5 turns, and keep the same direction, apply another 1.5 turns directly over the previous winding. Now we have two wires at the right side of the pipe coming out, which are the leads. Grab the coil like a slinky and pull it. Now Wesley's using 5 conductors. We're going to deal with just 1 conductor. Well, as you extend that slinky, you will have the exact pattern that Wesley is talking about as a Caduceus coil. Only it would be 5 conductors in parallel instead of 1. That's a pretty simplistic view. I think everybody can get that picture. It's sort of like a Chinese finger puzzle.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much true, John. You've described the primary winding. Now there's a secondary winding, which is the one that you were describing before, that you roll up by making the wire into a U-shape, fold it back on itself, tape it in the middle, and then roll it across the table.
Yes, exactly. And as that rolls up on that tube slips over the Caduceus tube coaxially, and that becomes the output, what he's calling the output winding. So we have a primary and a secondary. The primary is the Caduceus. Secondary is that wound rolling pin style, as I call it.
Now, what I was about to start saying to Wes is that I think Glenn has succeeded in making a coil with the right kind of a ferrite. He's made the, let's call it a transformer. He's made a transformer that is big enough where the windings are spread out enough that the stray capacitance between the windings is low enough that although, like every transformer, it has a resonance, the resonance could be so low in Q, so broadband in its resonance, that the signal generator you connect to the transformer, primary, is, by definition, a source of signal that has some particular 7 impedance, some particular source impedance. Let me drop. When a signal generator has has a particular source impedance to it. You may think it's a source of signal. Simultaneously, it is a load. Every real signal generator that's not a constant current generator, which means it's an almost open circuit, every real signal generator has some real output impedance, 50 ohms, 600 ohms, whatever. So although it's a source of signal, it's simultaneously a load. So if it happened to be a 600 ohm load signal generator, and you're therefore putting a 600 ohm resistive load across one of the windings, and if the transformer has a low enough LC ratio Q to begin with that load, the resonance is now spread out so wide that it's very difficult to see. It's almost not there. I think that's one possible explanation for why Wes in his measurements hasn't seen a transformer resonance. Does that seem to make some sense, John? KC2 WGB, K2RIW?
I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. And also, he is going to get several points where he's going to see a resonance. I would imagine the one with the biggest amplitude should be the closest one to resonance. But whether that'll be a factor in what he's going to do, I don't think so.
Yeah, the nice thing about a transformer that has very little distributed capacitance compared to its inductance, that has very low Q, means that a high percentage of the waveform you get out of that is a function of the waveform you put into it. That its own resonance, its self-resonance, being low in Q, means that it's not going to do what some transformers can do. Some transformers, you might attempt to put in a square wave, but because the resonance of the transformer is so high in Q, what you get out is a sine wave, even though you think you're putting in a square wave. I think the waveform he puts in and the waveform he gets out are going to have, at least at the tens of kilohertz that I believe he wants to operate at, I think he's going to have reasonably strong correlation between input waveform and output waveform. I also have the impression, I have the impression that with all these fancy signal generators he has the ability to make almost any voltage frequency, almost any voltage amplitude, almost any voltage waveform, almost any DC offset that he desires, whether or not he's going to use the green transformer feeding the Glen transformer, I'm not sure. I'm not quite sure what the green transformer is doing. What's stopping the signal generator to go straight to the flyback transformer? Why was the green transformer there?
The voltage of the regular generator is much smaller. We will need to have a 200 volts at the given shape and given amplitude and to exceed. Oh, by the way, you can check your email, and John, I sent you the second page of the Glen's transformer.
What was the approximate turns ratio of the green transformer, Wes?
Very easy to calculate. 200 volts divided by 9. 9 volts is one winding, 200 volts is the other one. And to XG.
20 to 1, Dick.
Gotcha.
Don't forget, that was driven by a photo-optical coupler and another IC. So they only had available 9 volts from the generator, and they had to get 200 volts and that isolate that 1 in 3 terminal on the flyback from putting any DC offset. The DC offset was only used to power the solid-state devices, I believe.
Did you check your email?
I did, and I'm looking at that page right now.
A question for Wes, if I may, Dick.
You've got it, John.
Wesley, you might want to give Dick a quick description of how you're going to use that transformer. The green transformer is not involved. You're going to couple it to the Fluke, the output of the Fluke, which is going to give you a 1,000-volt output. And remember, you were worried about the impedance matches that you were discussing that with Glen. You might want to run that by Dick.
Right. Thank you. Thank you, John. When I was playing with the second experiment, which was the ferrite yoke, I find out that because of mismatch of the impedance from the generator, which is 50 ohm, to the impedance of the primer of the winding that was on the yoke, I was getting only milliwatts on it, and we discussed that. But taking the same example, I have right now 1,000 volts or 1,100 volts from the master, from Fluke. That will deliver the voltage to the Glenn's transformer. Fluke does not have at the output 50 ohm. It does have a flat plug. Then a primary of the transformer represents, the Glenn's transformer represents a certain impedance. And the secondary of the transformer represents a certain impedance as well. What I'm trying to find out is how much of the losses do I have because of that. Glenn, based on the Glenn's description, I shouldn't be worried about that. And to exit.
Yeah, my gut feel is that Glenn's transformer is not going to be giving you any heat or dissipation. The green transformer, I don't know. When I look at the second sheet, the primary is called foil. Secondary, number 20 AWG at the top of the page. At the bottom right-hand side of the page, it says secondary trifolar 24 AWG. I thought this only has two windings. I'm beginning to think it's got a primary made of a foil. It's got one secondary with 20 gauge, and it's got another secondary trifolar with 24 gauge. Are there at least three windings there?
No, there are only two windings. I wonder if Glenn is available. Glenn, are you there?
Maybe he's doing a calculation for what would have happened if he used 20-gauge wire on the secondary, and then he did a calculation for what happens if he uses 24-gauge trifolar. Maybe that's what's going on. In other words, sort of like using lift wire. And he talks about 2.388 degrees centigrade temperature rise. I presume that's at a certain continuous power of input. And I presume he's talking about core temperature rise.
He says that this transformer is good for 5 kilowatts. All I need from that is milliamps or maybe microamps comparing to the green transformer.
Is Glenn's transformer substituting for the flyback or substituting for the green transformer?
Flyback. That would be no green transformer, no flyback. Enter G.
Now I see why John said both. So green and flyback disappear. Glenn's transformer goes there in between. And that in turn will fire the caduceus, which in turn will fire the light bulb.
Correct. Now, wave deck. 20 megahertz with swoop modulation generator that is model 193. John has one and I have exactly the same one. And this thing gives me any kind of waveform, although it does not give me ability to create a custom waveform. In other words, I have Interstate 25, P25, which if let's say I have a salt wave, I can create the salt wave out of the square wave in which the leading edge I'm simply bending creates a sharp edge at the end on the top. But I'm still leaving a flat horizontal part of the square wave at the bottom, which gave me somehow a shape that was very much recommended by Aronas, the guy who is mostly operating with the devices in our experiments. We have a generator that we tune to the Skype. Actually, we talk over the Skype, but we tune remotely from the Internet. And this guy suggests that the best shape for that would be starting from the bottom, below the zero, is flat, under the slope, up, vertically down, going below the zero, flat, horizontal, under the slope, up, and then drop down, horizontal, vertically. That's the shape that he recommends me to try with.
So it is a non-symmetric square wave that you're about to apply, is that what you're saying?
That's right. And so what I'm going to do is try different kind of shapes, but at the same time I'm going to try modulation. WaveTech is giving me the chance to give FM modulation on it with variable speed of modulation and the width of modulation. John would be able to explain that better. He's got that WaveTech long time ago from me. He said to myself, no, I gotta get it back. So I bought it 2 days ago. John, pick up.
Yeah, to sweep in frequency. Let me get a drop. To sweep in frequency to find out where you get the greatest action makes some sense. But when you finally find the area of greatest action, it's my belief that you're not going to want to use FM modulation. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
I agree, Dick. I don't think frequency modulation is going to do it for him. But he has a 166, which I just redid for him, and he can do FM or AM modulation on that. So he can play with the AM modulation, which I think will give him more of a... I think he'll get more of an effect out of that than he would to FM, without a doubt. Since he's already sweeping, what is he going to accomplish?
I have a few suggestions. Let's say I establish a sweep of the bandwidth of 1 kilohertz. In 193 WaveTech, I can have a start sweep and I can have a stop sweep. On the top of it, I can add up the amplitude modulation if I want. I mean, the results come from one single point. When somebody is playing with it like he doesn't know anything about electronics, just stupid moves. I remember the words of Ida. When he got into this, he says, if I start to think like a physicist, which is scientist in their language, I'm going to go nowhere. When I start to play with this, with the most controversial waves, I'm going to have interesting results. Back to you, Dick.
If you got the right kind of instrumentation with enough knobs, of course, try everything as long as it's not destructive. The 160 generator that you said you prepared for him, John, what's the lowest and highest frequency? What's the lowest and highest power? This signal generator, what waveform, what voltage, what frequencies, what can it generate, the one that you just prepared? Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Okay, this generator that I just did for him, I do not remember the frequency, but he can generate almost any kind of waveform he wants. Now, the confusion there with FM modulation, basically, when you take it out of the sweep mode and you put it in the FM modulation mode, you're going to be doing the same thing that it's doing at the sweep mode. And you have a knob which you can vary the sweep mode. So it's like a voltage-controlled oscillator, which is also one of the inputs. So whatever he sees when it's in the automatic sweep mode, he would see the same thing if he tried to put an FM modulation in it. AM, no. That will make a difference. That's my... Now, I don't know how many volts he can get out of it. You know, I had that thing running on the scope for so long. I didn't make any notes because I was just doing a little quick calibration and cleanup. The thing was a pigsty.
I believe 35 volts, and it's from 0 to 50 megahertz. That's 166. The 193 is from 0 to 20 megahertz. This one does not have one option that 166 has. it does not have a leading edge and trailing edge control, which 166 has.
The signal generator is called 166. Now, what brand name is that, John?
ATEC.
And is that a 50-ohm output signal generator?
Yes, 50-ohm and 600, I think.
I think WaveTech is WAVETEK or TECK.
TEK.
This one gives approximately 25 volts output. The 193 gives me, is listed for 30 volts, gives me about 40 volts output.
Yeah, but that depends on the impedance. It's going to be looking into also.
I think it says WaveTech 166 pulse / function generator. Is that the machine? A rectangular box. Upper left-hand corner is the frequency dial. It's got a zillion other knobs on it.
Very nice unit. And actually, now it's pristine.
Yeah, the one I'm looking at says freak range. 0001 hertz. That's a 0.1 millihertz up to 50 megahertz. That's a lot of octaves. Frequency accuracy 2% below 5 megs. Duty cycle 70% and so on. Pulse width 10 nano to 100 milli. Looks like this can do almost everything you want. In your opinion, John, what does a 193 give you that a 166 doesn't give you?
193 is a smaller package, lower frequency, and they're both very stable, but the 166 is a Cadillac.
In other words, the 193 doesn't give me control over the leading edge and trailing edge of the both.
Yeah, this looks like a nice machine. This is, John, is this owned by you or owned by Wes? Over to you, John.
No, Dick, Wesley purchased it last week, and it was in deplorable condition. Nothing worked right. All the controls were dirty and had a few breaks in a printed circuit board, but boy, it's humming now. Excellent machine. I love it.
So in other words, it was purchased at a nice price because of as-is, where-is, not guaranteed to be in good working condition. Is that what happened, John? Go ahead.
Yeah, Dick, I think he purchased it as it had signal, but that was all it. You know, they knew that when they pushed the button, it came on. That's about all he got.
I've got another one also, the Schwarz Burkhardt. John has a beautiful German precision in his hands. Dick, you wouldn't believe what he can do with the device. There was one device that he had made to the pristine condition, and I simply left it to him. Because I don't know how to appreciate the man who is using the heavy glasses just to work with it. But he has found so much patience and so much experience to deal with it. Back to you, Dick.
So I'm getting the impression right now that this WaveTech signal generator can go into that super high power amplifier, the one that's got the 4CX250B tubes, if you want to. That in turn goes into Glenn's transformer, which goes into the Caduceus, and from there on it's find out what kind of signal gives what kind of performance. Is that approximately what's going to take place? Is your impression, John? Go ahead.
Exactly, Dick. He's going to use that for his signal source into the Fluke, out of the Fluke into Glenn's transformer, and that Glenn's transformer is going to be tied to that 0.11. All of the rest of that junk is going to be gone. So we'll be dealing with that set of diodes and the Caduceus coil, and he's going to be playing with it like that, which I think will be a much more sane way of doing it. But I think he's going to need your advice on how to couple the primary of Glenn's transformer to the output of the Fluke. Now, I know it's flat to 100 KC, but Wesley said he's had it up to 17 to 10 to 17 megahertz, I believe. I do not know if he's going to get compliance at that frequency.
Let me pick it up. The Fluke is rated to 100 kilohertz only. I was driving 70 megahertz out of it. It still works. Fluke is absolutely amazing machine. Five ceramic tubes. I'm also thinking, how about if I tried it with much lower voltage? Let's say my WaveTec 193, although it does not have a control over the leading and trailing edge, gives me, let's say, 30 to 40 volts out. How about if I take this 40 volts out, deliver it to a Glenn's transformer, from Glenn's transformer go directly to point 11, and see what happens, and to exchange?
I say no.
The successful experiments that have been done by TK up till now, weren't they operating on numbers like 25 kilohertz? Over to you, Wes.
That's a good question. I spoke to TK, and he never mentioned that. Although, he mentioned that he's old, he's not good in health, and he doesn't want the technology to die with him. He was trying to commercialize it. He was trying to make money on it. His device does not use any power supply at all. It is one single point, pulse, from 9-volt battery. In various numbers of experiments that he was using also the battery charger or just a 12-volt battery. The experiment that I have seen by myself, he used, it's not him. He was lying in a bed, sick, semi-conscious. I wasn't feeling bad. Good at the same time. There was a number of reasons, I don't want to go into that. He ordered the guy that he called to make a device for me. That was 4 o'clock p.m. in Saturday. In Sunday. At about 2 o'clock during the night time, I was called. I came to the garage. At this garage, there was a device, not connected to any wires at all. It was one single wire that was a ground wire. And he used the battery charger to make one single point, one single pulse. Of course, that event was well documented on the videotape. From that point, the device started to work. And it was working for 30 minutes without any interruption. The 200 watt light bulbs were leading with no change of the brightness. That was for me enough just to believe that that's what I'm seeing, is that's what I've seen before in his presentations of 3 kilowatts, 5 kilowatts, and 100 kilowatts in Turkey. So far, till today, no one claimed that his device is a phony or it doesn't work. Even the company who put thousands of dollars into make that experiment for 100 device with 100 kilowatts of power, that company never claimed that this device is not working. Also, there was a number of scientists and the president-elect of his country who was called to see the device in the 90s. And he managed to disconnect the power from part of the city to make sure that the electricity doesn't come from any other source but from the device of TK. And to Adrian.
Sure, Wes, we've got 15 minutes.
To ZA. I think I heard something ZA. Go right ahead.
To ZA, question on...
I think you're on a handy talkie and you walked to a place where you faded out. And to ZEA, start off with your name and repeat your question or comment.
It's Glenn from 2ZX Alpha, and I have an unrelated question when you guys have a minute.
Okay, let's hope that you can stay in one position long enough for us to hear you. Go ahead.
question about a Mirage amplifier. I have it's a B215G. It's got a 2-watt input and 150-watt output. And my question is that my transmitter's lowest power only goes down to 10 watts. Am I going to damage the thing, or is it just going to distort, or what do you think will happen?
I think you got to... Let me drop this. I think you got to be careful. You better read the data sheet from Mirage. If it's rated for 2 watts input and you were putting in 3 or 4 watts, I'd say, yeah, okay. 10 watts on a 2 watt input, I think there's a chance you could damage the first stage. You better read the data sheet. Go ahead.
Okay, sounds good. And the second question is, I had an old diamond antenna up on the roof, 2-meter. I told you a couple weeks ago, you told me to replace it, and I did. So the old antenna, is that repairable, or is there any way I can retune it for 2 meters?
The diamond antenna on the roof is made for what frequency?
The 2-meter 440. It went out of tune, and the SWR went off the scale, so I replaced it. So it's just sitting around. I was wondering if it's repairable.
If nobody has removed any parts and you haven't burned something up with proper study, I think almost any antenna that fails to operate can be put back into operation. But the only thing I can think of is if you put 1,000 watts into it and burn something up, then the repair might be kind of extensive. But with proper analysis, I see no reason why that shouldn't be able to be put back into operation. Therefore, you're going to have two of them eventually.
Antenna.
Go ahead, John.
I'd like to know if that's a 550HN.
It was, I think, an X6000. It was a 2-meter 440.
Yes, that has the plastic radome on it.
Yes, I think it's fiberless.
Yes, okay. If you take that apart, that antenna, you're going to see it has a center joint with, I don't know if you have the special wrenches. You may have gotten the wrenches with your new one. You take that apart, you're probably going to find water inside of there. I've had that problem before on them.
So if the water's cleaned out and I dry out the antenna, you think it might work again?
Oh, absolutely. You can just take it apart very carefully, because that's a very critical point where you separate that and join those two pieces. Look down inside, you know, turn it upside down. You could have any kind of foreign material in there, and that will affect it. Take some ohm meter readings. Make sure your end connector, I believe that one has an end connector at the bottom. Make sure that's in good shape, and check the center pin, that it hasn't broken or received damage from somebody trying to remove it a little too roughly.
And the DC impedance, of course, is measuring,
I believe that is a DC antenna, if I remember correctly. You may measure a dead short across that. But examine that F connector. Very, very good, because the female part of it can be damaged from somebody wiggling it as they're trying to insert the connector. And that will cause SWR problems on that antenna like crazy. I'm sure Dick knows about that, too.
Sounds good. Thank you for the help, Jim. I appreciate it. Thank you, medical office.
Yeah, good luck with that operation. Okay. What's next for you guys?
I would like to, you to go to the crayon drawing and try to at least comment on that fleet that is in between Koyo Kabasar and the Caduceus. What is the role of it, how it works, and whatsoever. And also, I spoke to president of the club, and he said that he is willing to extend the hours of the repeater for the TechNet. If, let's say, we have a need just to discuss further, or we don't have a time just to finish something that we started, and to actually...
Lots to ask from Dick, though.
Yeah, my family thinks that the TechNet stops at midnight, and they give me flack, particularly when there's work the next day. I do have to go to a series of meetings tomorrow, even though it's not a work day. So I think the number of hours we got right now is sufficient. What about you guys?
Thought it earlier.
No, I understand that. What I'm saying is, if, let's say, we have a situation in which something is unfinished, but we know that you can control the time of the technet at any time you want to, 11, 12, 1 o'clock, whatever time is comfortable to you, Dick. At least we know that the repeater is not going to go off. He said that he's going to send a letter to Eric and ask him to extend the hours for the repeater just for your comfortability. This will eliminate part of the conversation during the week time that we have with John, at least, because most of that would be explained. Now, if you could comment shortly on that that sleet that is connected to the lower light bulb on the crayon drawing.
I think you're talking about the CL3 device, is that true? And right now, with one of those diagrams, that thing is simply a spark gap. That CL3 spark gap in series with an incandescent bulb that goes back to the winding of the coil transformer, coil capacitor. Wow. Yeah, if the voltage is high enough and the frequency is high enough, that that piece of CL3 is a capacitor to ground, and if the voltage you put on the left-hand side of the light bulb is big enough and spiky enough, the arc gap, the spark gap there will give you enough voltage across the incandescent light bulb. That's a difficult circuit.
So also, the slit is exactly of the length of the ferrite.
Yeah, I've heard you say that, and I don't have a simple explanation for what's going on there.
Do you see any correlation of the ferrite and the slit, or role of the ferrite, because without the ferrite doesn't work?
Well, the ferrite certainly changes the inductance of the caduceus coil, and that'll change its resonant frequency. It'll change a lot of things about its operation. And so, without the ferrite, you're saying that circuit with the CL3 doesn't work. I'll take your word for it.
Not even with the pickup coil. It doesn't work.
When you say pickup coil, you mean the neat diagram. So, each diagram requires a ferrite rod, I think you're saying.
Correct.
Okay. With the ferrite rod, which drastically increases the amount of inductance of every one of your windings, which drastically increases the amount of stored energy on each half cycle. That's a guess. You're going to have a certain amount of stored energy so that you can get enough stored energy across the capacitor, across the spark gap, in order to do the action with the light bulb. But that's a pure guess on my part. Eventually, as you get the thing working with your new test equipment, once you get it in operation, then step by step you can measure what current, what voltage, at what point, and if TK's circuit did its operation at 25 kilohertz, and if your Fluke can be a beautiful operational amplifier to at least 100 kilohertz, sounds to me like you've got lots of testing capability. KQRIW.
Yeah, of course. Without any problem, it's rated for 100 kilohertz. I can work with it. What I was trying to say is, with ferrite doesn't work, and without that slit doesn't work. With the coil capacitor, you have a coil capacitor on the crayon drawing. Without that slit doesn't work. We're trying different kind of configuration. It doesn't work. Enter a gist. Oh, another thing is, don't you think that that upper light bulb that is barely leading is giving us the resistive component to LC circuit? What we have is the upper light bulb is connected to one winding of the coil capacitor, and the lower light bulb is connected in different fashion. Don't you think that the upper light bulb is just having some kind of role where the resistance is needed?
Don't have a good explanation on that one, Wes. John, on a slightly different subject, you've heard me from week to week. I've operated on this particular microphone today. Is it better, worse, or the same from your point of view, John? KC2WGB, KQRIW.
Dick, what I've noticed is there's no more static, no more crackling. So whatever you did, help that. But also, your highs have increased. Your high frequencies are right up there now, where before it was slightly muffled. I think you did a good job. I think it's working fine.
I like better the old one.
In other words, you like a rounder voice with less high-frequency notes. I understand. The foam that they've got in the front piece of these microphones, after a certain number of years, it starts turning into mush. On top of that, all of the moisture and everything else that gets in there from talking in front of it eventually gums it up. So I think that's one of the mechanisms by which some microphones lose high frequencies. If I turn off the speech processor, which I'm about to do, Wes, there it is with no speech processor.
Horrible.
Yeah, to you it's horrible. Let's see how it is to Wes. Wes, do you like that better or worse?
No, without the speech processor, it's horrible. It's flat.
Okay, you like the speech processor. The Kenwood 711, is that what I'm using? Yeah, Kenwood 711. When you press the button on the far left-hand side, you've got a speech processor. It looks like most people like that speech processor. And I can go back to one other microphone. Let me do that right now. This is microphone, the one that I operated on today. Stand by. This is a microphone that has never been operated on. This is a virgin microphone. Over to you, John, K2LAW. What do you think?
That mic is actually terrible, Dick. It has a lot of distortion compared to the one you were just on. That mic you were just on, that you've been using, is nice and crisp. This one's got a little mush to it and some noise. So you may want to perform surgery on that one also.
Yeah, sometimes the noise you hear is me moving my hands, like if I do things like this. So some of those cracklies I'm making with my hand. A smarter guy would have, you know, a boom mic or whatever. Okay, I've got no good explanation for what that upper light bulb is doing. I don't even have to ask you. I know the answer is, if you remove the dim upper light bulb, the whole circuit changes. That's my guess. WS2N, I mean, here we go. N2XJN, boy, I'm losing it. N2XJN, K2LAW.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. This is the most mysterious schematic that Creon drawing. I love it because of the structure it is made. And I believe that I have sent you also the drawing, the picture of the original TK core capacitor. And that would be the attachment, just a moment, the first one. Coil capacitor of TK, DSC07824JPG. And if you look at that picture, it shows clearly it's a pancake structure that has some kind of rod inside. Whether this is a ferrite, it doesn't look like a ferrite, it looks like a shiny. Do you see that picture?
The one you want me to see, the TK circuit, you're going to have to tell me what date and hour you mailed.
Not today. There was the same email. It's just position number one. Point number one, DSC07824JPG - coil capacitor of TK. That was the first the question for the technet. I mean, the one that I sent you, that we were discussing with all of the schematics in it.
Okay, the one that was sent earlier today has got numbers 1 through 9. That's the right one?
Right.
And
I do apologize if I'm not exactly as precise as you are.
RC2N repeater controller V5.282. Clock not set. Clock not set. Ready.
Okay, somebody was playing with the repeater.
Welcome to the
guys can continue. I reset things. It's supposed to go off at 2, but now it's working again.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you, Eric. Dick, are you still there? No, it looks like Dick is no longer with us. He probably thought that the repeater is off and is not going to be connected. also, Vernie, thank you very much. Vernie, are you still with us? Oh, Vernie is not with us. Vernie, thank you very much for your interest in this area and whatever is taking long, we're going to be delivering that information to the public, so the public will be aware of the subject. And eventually, if we succeed, the schematic and the diagram and the working model will be delivered to the public. No secrets. And to XGM.
Okay, Wes. Well, Bernie's going to work on a system where what I email him, he can post, and it'll be a little more convenient for everybody to just drop in and see what's going on. So, thanks to Bernie, that'll be taken care of. We'll just keep making adjustments until everybody's happy.
Of course, Sam, thank you to Eric. Eric, you're a great man. Thank you for giving us additional time to talk on the repeater. Eric? I didn't get Eric. Okay, John. So, tomorrow in the morning I'm going to get up and at least prepare myself, prepare the table, make... The problem that I have in here is I have too many instruments. With a high voltage, I'm afraid I don't want to lose this stuff. I thought that I'm closed the door from the rack in order for me to make sure that very expensive equipment will not be damaged. But I have only one oscilloscope apart from one that is in the rack that is an analog oscilloscope, which I'm not really worried about it. I didn't pay much for it. It's a Kikuchi. I just don't know what am I going to do. I mean, removing all of the shelves with all of this equipment just for that, or maybe set up another table next to the rack and somehow being able to use the Tektronix oscilloscope for it.
I got the answer for you.
Go ahead.
When you get a chance, buy a bunch of shorting BNC connectors or make them. Put them on every device you have. And then the device you're going to use and only that one input, that's the one that you'll open up and use. All the rest of your devices, anything with a BNC connector, put it on there, especially if it's like a 1 megohm input. Put those shorting connectors on there, and you won't have any problem with the equipment.
Oh, boy, that's a good answer. That's a very good answer. Shorting BNCs. I could have it done. I have a BNCs that were made for the closed-circuit TVs. I believe I have plenty of them. All I have to do is just make a short.
I know they do make ones at certain BNCs. You can just fill them with solder, and that'll complete your short connection, you know.
Oh, I didn't see those. I should have enough. I need like 30 of them. I have to count how many, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Again, the old oscilloscope, I have 5 BNCs, then all of the frequency counters, all of the stuff. Boy, Wincare, 8 of them. I have to remove the cables that I have on it, the 4 lead cables, and put 8 of them. And then in the rug, I have like 20.
Yeah, so get yourself like 50 of them and just do them up. Give me a second. I'll be right back.
Okay, I'll be right back.
Somebody's told me that my transmitter seems intermittent. Is my carrier dropping up and down?
No, it is not. Everything is perfect.
Okay, it's sounds like an intermittent. They seem like the hardest problems to find. But at HT, it's a mobile unit on a 12-volt supply.
I don't see any problems with it. Are you the person who is overdriving Mirage?
Yeah, I don't have the amplifier on. It's just about 40 watts out of the mobile rig. I looked up some of the specs on it, and it said it'll go up to about 8 watts before it trips out, so I'm going to hook up our power cable to the power supply and see if I can hook that up as well.
Oh, I see. Well, definitely, overdriving Mirage is not healthy. I would not recommend that. I wonder if John is back. No, he's not yet. Okay, so... is this the only radio that you have?
No, I have an ICOM 706. That's not hooked up yet. That's sitting on the side. My power meter says on low power I'm only putting out about 4 watts. I don't know if the meter's accurate. The manual on the ICOM says low power is supposed to be 10 watts. Maybe it's over-enthusiastic. I don't know.
But right now, you use only 4 watts. You don't use the amplifier?
No, it's high power. It's about 40 watts on the meter. And yeah, I'm getting antennas up about 30 feet in the air. I'm out in Suffolk County, about Islip.
Back.
Okay. Well, you coming to the repeater with the full strength with no problems at all. 4 watts is plenty. If I put 4 watts into my radio, I'm gonna sound like that. Hold on. Okay, this is less than 4 watts. No. This is 7 watts. I'm coming with 7 watts. And to actually.
Really couldn't hear the difference. It sounds pretty good. I'll let you guys get back to your conversation. I appreciate the help. N2Z Echo Alpha.
Okay, no problem at all. No problem at all. Okay, John. So, I'm going to have a BNC connector prepared for tomorrow. So, most of the day, I'm going to be probably soldering those. You remember how those twist-on connectors BNC looks like from the closed-circuit TV? I have to put the piece of coax slide into it, make sure that it has a good contact, and then simply solder the ends of it. Make sure that the coax does not extend from the BNC connector. And to exit.
Yeah, okay, do you have the ones with the loose pins? You put the pin on the cable first and then insert it? Is that the type you have?
No, those are twist-on. They have a thread inside. So when you prepare first with a stripper, your coaxial cable RG59, and then you put that into the BNC connector, then you twist-on. And while you're screwing the connector, and the center pin goes exactly in the middle, and the shield is touching the size of the thread, and the thread is long for approximately half of an inch, and that's how it works. So that's what I'm going to be playing tomorrow with.
So in other words, the pin is in the unit, in the connector already. It's not loose. I didn't hear that.
That is correct.
Okay, then what you do is you just take a piece of solder, piece of copper wire, slide it down into the pin and solder it. Then you bend the wire over and just solder it to the barrel. Don't even worry about crimping it or threading it or any of that nonsense.
Correct.
Okay, so, but you got to make up like 50. Wow, that's a lot. But that'll keep you out of trouble for sure.
Yes, I'm going to see how many of them do I have. I'm going to probably find around 20, lying somewhere around, to go to another house. So most of the day before I come to you, I will spend doing those connectors. Then I have a collection of the spark tubes. I have to prepare the holders for them, so they are nicely lying on a piece of wood and make a bracket for the caduceus coil that I can seat that caduceus horizontally and will not move. That would be done from wood as well. So probably I'm going to go down there to the basement, to the second house, and play with plates and maybe with one of the mills. I have the frequency drive, variable frequency drive, that I didn't connect ever to the second mill, which is manual. So you have plenty of things to be done for the preparation. And when I'm ready, probably it's going to take me 2 days, and I'm going to start to work with it. I was in the middle of preparing another video from the measurement of the transformer, Glenn transformer, and that usually takes me a few days, but I think I'm going to give up on it.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
All right. You also have to work out, which you didn't speak to Dick about, connecting that to the fluke. The primary of his coil directly to the fluke. And then try some different generating patterns. Put it in 1 or 2 volts. This way you'll only be dealing with maybe 50 volts on the output. Maybe 100 volts. You don't have to go crazy. And see what happens at the secondary end of his transformer. And then put some loads on it and see if the fluke can keep up with it.
I hope that what Glenn said will be true, that when I connect the transformer, the impedance would not be critical, and I would be able to have uninterrupted high voltage source of 10,000 volts, the max. I mean, we've been dealing with 10,000 volts. I can deal with what? Try to see 6,000, 7,000 volts. See what's happened.
Well, I wouldn't go that high. So you, you know, just look for 100 volts out of that fluke. Put 100 volts in there. You'll get 1,000 volts out of Glenn's transformer. I'm not questioning Glenn's transformer. I'm questioning the limiting circuit on the fluke. And maybe you could put a couple of bulbs on the secondary and see what happens. And, you know, run your generator up and down, look at different wave shapes, and see what effect it has.
There is a generator, Agilent, or Hewlett-Packard 214B. It's a pulse generator. And it's a high-power pulse generator. It gives 100 volts out, up to 10 megahertz. It was specially designed for the laser diode. Now, this thing is very much inexpensive. They ask for it $195, but this is for a damaged one. The cheapest price is somewhere from $420 to $499, give the offer. So, assuming $400 should make it, I'm a little bit reluctant to spend the money but it looks like a good stuff.